6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take it to another.
And good afternoon. Welcome to this Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. With us in the WORT studio are two significant, longtime friends of WORT, Matt Rothschild and Bob McChesney. And, you know, we thought we'd bat some current events around this hour in order to provide some context, some deeper understanding that, again, you're not going to get from the mainstream media conglomerates. Matt, of course, is the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and previously he was longtime editor of the Progressive magazine. But since joining the WDC, he's been traveling around the state on numerous speaking engagements, voicing his concerns and gauging really the mood at various locales, and we'll talk about that a little bit hopefully this hour. Bob McChesney is an activist scholar and professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He specializes in the history and political economy of mass communication, and certainly has been quite attentive. I want to talk about the media this hour because it appears as if, though we're often critical of places, you know, outlets like the Washington Post and the New York Times, that, well, the media is not solely simply, as we often describe it, a stenographer of power, but places the Post, the New York Times, even CNN, that they're finding some spine. And we want to talk, that seemingly doesn't jibe with some of the theory that's out there. So we'll be talking about that. 256-2001, Matt and Bob, having you both here together today, my dear friends, it's a pleasure. So welcome.
It's a gas to be here.
A gas to be here. Matt, you have nothing to say to that?
I'm trying to keep it clean.
we'll get to the F word later. But Bob, let's start with you. That is, you know, well, first of all, this news this week has been incredible. Just in the last number of days, an incredible week of increasing discernible instability for the new administration. We've had Flynn's resignation as national security advisor. He's described himself in the process as being a scapegoat, which insinuates that there are others. That he's falling, you know, the military guy falling on his sword. There's the New York Times story that the administration was actually aware of Flynn's activity and they kept it from Pence, that the Trump people, insiders knew. Then there's this Puzder withdrawal for Secretary of Labor. So, and then now there's news stories today regarding the counteroffensive by the intelligence community and Trump's vow to go after leakers and whistleblowers. He still, you know, he got himself in this jam, I would argue, by messing with the national security apparatus and the news media concurrently. And so I'm wondering what your take is on some of this.
Well, you know, I think the way you framed it, Alan, which is, you know, the Washington Post and CNN and the New York Times have found some spine, far more spine than we've come to expect from them. You know, I think we should congratulate them to the extent that's true, but I think we should qualify that because really you also answered the question the next thing you said, which is what the news media does at its best is accurately report on conflicts among ruling elites. And so those are the main political debates within the parameters of the establishment. And clearly that's what's going on here. Donald Trump is at war with the national security establishment. And that's a war even Joe McCarthy learned you don't want to get into, no matter how much political support you might have otherwise. And it's an inside fight. And that emboldens then journalists because they have sources giving them really good material constantly, people they rely on normally for their material, giving them this great material on Russia and Trump to work with. And so I think that explains to no small extent why this sort of story gets picked up. And similarly important stories that basically aren't of interest to those debating policy at the highest levels don't get picked up at all about U.S. foreign policy or U.S. presidential conduct.
An example of that?
Yeah, sure. But President Obama basically continued many of the policies on human rights and that President George W. Bush had. And while they were howls of outrage when Obama, the candidate, was running, Obama, the president, did more or less the same stuff, or the increasing drone attacks. And it was not a news story at all. It could have certainly been a great news story. It's a legitimate story. But since leaders of both parties were in on it, it really wasn't an issue where the sources that reporters depend on were feeding them information they could work with.
I mean, another example, a current one is, you know, there's all this discussion about Russia meddling in U.S. elections. I scoured the news media and didn't see any stories about the United States meddling in other countries' elections. Yeah. And that's what the CIA does professionally.
All
the United
time.
States did it in the Ukrainian elections. You know, the United States has destabilized allies like Australia in their elections back in the 70s and early 80s.
If our guy loses an election, we just overthrow the government.
Yeah.
In Honduras.
I mean, so that frame it was just totally absent.
With our guests today, Bob McChesney and Matt Rothschild, let's continue on with this, you know, looking at reviewing the news of the week this morning in preparation for the program. I was really astounded by how quickly all of this seems to be, this administration seems to be unhinged, unraveling. But it also suggests, you know, lots of folks are saying, oh, that's great. But it could be ominous. That is, like, it really could be quite dangerous because, like, cornered wild animals, these folks around Trump and Trump himself seemingly often unhinged. I mean, there's a fantastic column yesterday from E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post entitled "Admit It, Trump is Unfit to Serve." Haven't seen a headline like that or a story like that since late in the Watergate crisis.
Well, you know, we saw lots of stories like that during the campaign, though. I think that's what this whole surreal period we're in right now is about, which is that it was pretty obvious until he won the election, and then we had to take him seriously. The news media took him seriously as a legitimate president, that this guy really had no business being in office. And this was something Republicans were candidly saying throughout the you know, nomination process for the Republican nomination and through the convention when many of them refused to even go to the convention to legitimate Trump's nomination as the Republican candidate. So, I mean, now we're getting a president. Usually they back off, say, well, the will of the people has spoken. We have to take this guy seriously and treat him like we do anyone else who gets elected. He's in power, and our job is to report accurately and fairly what he says. But, I mean, in Trump's case, he's so outside the mold of what someone in power should be like. Even I mean, there's two things. There's these positions, which are sort of borderline fascist at times and bizarre at other times. And then there's personal psychology, which is frightening. I mean, by any standard, the guy lacks wisdom entirely. He's completely unfit for public office. He's a TV guy. And so I think I'm not so surprised by E.J. Dionne's thing. I think everyone said this, that he wrote it. I don't think it's that much of a surprise. People have been saying that all along. It was just a brief honeymoon he got of a few weeks.
But I also don't think that he's going to go away anytime soon. I know there's this hope among many decent people that, you know, rid us of this man and, you know, let's force him to resign or start impeachment proceedings right away. And though there are grounds for it, certainly, I don't see it happening because, first of all, I think the Republican majority wants to see him succeed, at least in the short term, so they can ram through their corporatist agenda, you know, the Paul Ryan privatization agenda that they wanted to ram through forever. And then the far-right people, the Bannon group, the fascist pull and tug, you know, they want to impose fascism. And so they're going to cling to power. And actually, I think there may be a wholesale purging of the intelligence community and the FBI. Kellyanne Conway, even before all this broke, said we got to put our own people in there. And clearly there are lots of leaks from the intelligence community, people who don't like them for obvious reasons. And so, you know, that purge might happen. And if he puts in his people there, you know, he may be able to do more damage. I also think we're going to see Trump rallies all across the country because the guy's ego is so needy and he's not having any fun right now as president and he needs to feed that narcissistic ego. He's going to have mass rallies. He's starting to have one this Saturday in Florida, and I think he'll have those all over the country, at least where he's popular.
Yeah, a kind of mobilization, not just a psychological need, but a mobilization of a right populist base.
Well, yeah, Bannon knows all about that. So they get the social base that's always been out there in the streets for fascists.
We have a caller waiting on the line now for a little while. Chris, you're on the air.
Gentlemen, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, so one of the things that I kind of feel what is being pushed through the media, and you can see it very clearly, and especially in the mainstream media, is the big push about Flynn being fired and how chaotic the White House administration is and how out of control it is and Donald Trump being unfit for this position. But have you gentlemen ever heard of PRS, problem, reaction, solution? You create the problem, you watch the reaction of the people, and you provide the solution. And governments and officials have done that for years to maintain power, to gain the control and the support of the citizens of that country. And when you listen to some of the close people within the Trump administration who helped get him elected, especially somebody similar to Steve Pachenik, he talks about, you know, that this was a soft coup installing Donald Trump into office, and it's cleaning up the administration, and it's not just the Obama administration, but in general the neocons and the government itself. And so if you're in control of the situation and you create these problems thus in place, putting Flynn into a position that they knew would be temporary, and the people take the bait and they run down that rat hole, you're controlling the outcome of the story, and what you're also doing is bringing to the surface the moles and the people that are extremely anti-Trump and the people that are trying to prevent him and his administration from succeeding. And I bet you you'll be seeing in the next few weeks another person that will be leaving his administration will be Rance Priebus. And you have to look at this from a strategic standpoint that maybe these things were known in advance and they were set up for people to take the bait, and mainstream media is the perfect example of taking this and running with it and making a bigger deal on something that really never broke the laws, but they're trying to get the general people to believe that laws were broken and that the administration is out of control.
Well, I don't think that Chris is right that Flynn was bait and he was just thrown out to kind of chum the waters there. I do agree that Priebus may go. He doesn't seem to be real popular. I also, where I thought Chris was going originally was, you know, you have all the mainstream media focusing on the incompetence as though it would be great if he's competent. and I don't want to see that. I mean, I remember my old boss over at the Progressive, Irwin Knoll, who said, you know, the more paralyzed the government is, the more incompetent they are, the better, because they can't do bad stuff. And Paul Krugman, the New York Times, had a great line saying, you know, this is malevolence tempered by incompetence. I want to see it malevolence consumed by incompetence, because what I worry about is that the David Gergens of this world, you know, the gargoyles of the Washington establishment, you know, if Trump gets a good chief of staff and starts running according to Hoyle, that they'll start, you know, applauding for him for getting his act together, and then real damage could be done.
You know, it's this Russia thing is sort of distinct. I think what Trump's doing domestically wouldn't be raising cackles, you know, getting rid of public education, trashing unions. That gets popular resistance, but at the elite level, I don't think that's really a cause for concern. But I think the whole Russia thing is a problem because this is he's really going outside the mainstream of the national security establishment in both parties right now by not being lining up with the demonization of Russia. Now, I'm sympathetic to people who say that's really a lame issue, that we shouldn't be demonizing Russia. There's really no justification for it. But having said that, that doesn't make me sympathetic to Trump one iota. I mean, I think Trump is, as Matt said, an appalling figure. And so, I mean, I don't know. This is a complicated issue, I think.
I mean, sometimes he does arrive at a rational position, though. And having better relations with Russia is a rational position.
That's
if you juxtapose that to Hillary Clinton, who wanted to shoot down Russian planes over Syria, which was insanity, I mean...
Yeah, exactly.
He sometimes reaches a rational position. That's what, like the perennial
clock,
blind squirrel finding a nut.
Yeah, exactly.
Or sometimes when he is totally unprepared for a question and he tries to sort it through in his mind on the spot, as he did in one of the debates when he was asked, should we be, you know, use nuclear weapons first? And, of course, it's irrational for anyone to use nuclear weapons first because it's going to end up blowing up the world. So he said, no, I don't want to do that. And then the establishment went nuts because it's been our doctrine since 1945 to have first use of nuclear weapons.
Yep.
Listening to the caller, I found myself thinking that there's, I was wondering where he was going to go with it as well, and I thought, and I was kind of double thinking, well, there's all this kind of theory of various deep state conspiracies and so on, but both of you spend a lot of time contextualizing in a different fashion, that the crisis of the brand new administration is not just a crisis of Trump and company, but it reflects a deeper ongoing crisis in this society, the culture, this political economy. Bob, you've written at length about this. Talk about that a little bit. How do you contextualize it in that bigger picture?
Yeah, that's a great question, Alan, because I think people, because we get caught up in the moment, and Trump got elected, quasi-elected president, 3 million fewer votes, but still elected by the Electoral College system. Because we get caught up in Trump being in power and what he's trying to do and his personality, we lose sight of the fact that the Trump's election itself was something completely unexpected and abnormal by historical patterns, and that we're really in a rare period historically in this country. This is not business as usual. And Trump, if we just got rid of Trump, things would go back to the good old days of having the narrow range of Hillary Clinton to Mitt Romney as the range of legitimate debate. I think we're in a period of tremendous turmoil. And I would say until Election Day, or certainly until a year ago, I was optimistic this was going to turn out a lot better than it has right now. And I still am optimistic for the long term, but the short term has me scared to death. But, I mean, we look at the presidential race in 2016. It wasn't just on the Republican side with the complete rejection of the Republican establishment by their voters and the embrace of Trump. On the Democratic side, you had something even more extraordinary, the Sanders campaign, which has been sort of gone down the memory hole now, exactly what happened and the weakness of Hillary Clinton. But that suggests, you know, and I'm a college professor, so I'm talking to young people all the time, and I'm seeing young people, and, you know, there was something going on this year. There is something going on with people under the age of 30 that has been completely forgotten. It briefly was recognized during the success of the Sanders campaign a year ago. This country is ripe for fundamental social change, progressive social change, in a way it hasn't been in decades. This would have been impossible 20, 30 years ago. And the Trump thing has sort of got lost us that it's just this right-wing threat to normalcy, which was working fine. The status quo of this country, the political economy, is in deep crisis across the board. Both parties are stumbling and not failing to offer answers. Both are in need of dramatic change. We need new voices. And I think that's the moment that should be remembered. Not that Trump's just sort of snuck in by accident and then we'll go back to normal and we'll all live happily ever after. The conditions in this country for the last two or three decades, living standards for people, the state, the quality of society, the growth of inequality, the rampant growth of militarism, the insecurity of life in general for people has grown dramatically. The future for people under the age of 30 in this country, Matt and I have kids living through it, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners do, is more dire than it's been in 80 years in this country. And there's no signs for anything better on the horizon. We have deep fundamental problems, and they're going to have to be addressed one way or the other. The way we're addressing them with Trump, obviously, is the wrong way. But they're not going away. They're only going to get worse, a lot worse.
Well, and let me just do a little contextualizing of my own off of what Bob has been teaching forever. And from 30,000 feet, it's obvious what's going on. Capitalism's devouring our democracy. That is what's happening. We see that capitalism is not delivering for people here in the United States or around the world. Neoliberalism, call it what you want, that people are stagnant and their wages aren't growing and they feel resentful because they're just standing in place and treading water. And politically, the top 1% or 0.1% has gotten so much of the power that they can buy the politicians. And Trump said that at the first Republican debate. I give money to all these guys and when I call, they do what I want to do. And people were pleased that he said the young unassailable. But people are very resentful of the fact that we only have a formal democracy here, and they're very resentful of their economic conditions. And so Trump capitalized on that resentment. Bernie Sanders talked about the system being rigged. Elizabeth Warren talked about the system being rigged long before Trump did. I mean, you can call up on YouTube a speech by Elizabeth Warren where she uses the adjective rigged about 10 times in 2 minutes. And then Trump comes along. I mean, he knows a good line when he steals it and started to talk about the system being rigged.
And of course, the same Elizabeth Warren that was silenced on the floor of the Senate over this debate, you know, on sessions and so on. More recent book, People Get Ready, from Bob and John Nichols.
Let me just jump in 1 second there, because in People Get Ready, Bob and John predict the possibility. They use the F word in there. And they suggest that if conditions don't improve, there could be a fascist person who takes over. And that has just happened a little more quickly than you predicted.
Yeah, we thought it was, when we finished the draft of the introduction in the middle of 2015, we sent it to our editor and we say, you know, when you go into a situation of rising inequality and unemployment and underemployment, you know, one of the things that happens historically worldwide and in capitalist societies, you see the emergence of fascism as the center collapses, along with democratic socialism on the left. And our editor says, you can't use the word fascism in a book aimed at America.
That F word.
Yeah. The F word. No one's going to buy that. They're going to think you're a lunatic. You're off the deep end. And then a few months later, when Trump started catching on, she sent back a note saying, you know, I apologize. You guys were just, it happened a little bit sooner than even you anticipated. And she's right. It has happened sooner. But it is defeatable. But we have to learn from the past to win
in
the future.
And we see it all over. I mean, Marie Le Pen may be the next leader of France. I mean, this is, you know, it's happening everywhere.
You know, I just saw a news item the other day that this guy that was present at one of the inaugural balls was this Hungarian who has some place in the new administration, Hungarian immigre, and he was wearing the traditional dress garb of the old Hungarian fascist movement and wearing these medals celebrating the Hungarian fascist Horthy. And there he is at this inaugural ball, all dressed up.
Well, listen to this. Sean Hannity had him on Fox News last night and introduced him as someone who was being victimized by Saul Alinsky tactics. So they're blaming the Jews for having a fascist in power in Christmas. <Chris God>.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Claire has been waiting a bit. Hi, Claire. You're on the air.
Hi, Alan. Thank you. I'd like to raise the issue of redistricting, because until we get this mess straightened out, which is ripping off taxpayers, of course, having to defend it, number one, and then paying law firms to rig it once again, just burns me up. And how are we ever going to win? Because, as I recall, there were more Democratic voters in Wisconsin in the last election, and we still lost all over the place. And I'd like to get your guest take on that.
Well, Claire, thanks for calling. It's always nice to hear your voice on the air, by the way. The good news on redistricting, this is where the good guys have won, at least in federal court, actually won a historic victory over the last couple months, where for the first time ever, a panel of federal judges said that the partisan gerrymandering, the rigging of the district maps, was unconstitutional. And the plaintiffs put on a great case. I was at the Blue Federal Building here in Madison and was witnessing the closing arguments as well as other parts of the trial, and it was just a tremendous trial. And this is a great victory. Now, of course, the Walker people, rather than doing what the panel said to the legislature, was you go back and redraw maps, this time make them constitutional. They don't want to do that, so they are appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court. Brad Schimmel, the Attorney General of the state, is appealing to the U.S. Supreme Court. And now the legislators, on top of that, Fitzgerald and Voss, are spending, you know, six figures more to pay fancy, pricey lawyers to try to defend their unconstitutional rigging of the maps rather than going back and drawing decent maps. And the long-term solution is for us to have our maps drawn by career nonpartisan civil servants like they do in Iowa. Iowa's been doing it for 35 years, and they have fair maps that are not rigged every 10 years when the census comes out, depending on who's in power.
You know, this morning I was looking at this thing that comes out, a weekly digest of news items from Harper's Magazine, and it recounted, and you read it as a list of what's been going on. And it's just phenomenal. But one of the things that just now leapt out at me was this business of Ivanka Trump's clothing line. And it kind of speaks legions, really. It's a minor story, but, you know, this spat, well, Nordstrom said, Nordstrom's department store chain said, well, we're not going to carry Ivanka's line. And the President of the United States and Kellyanne Conway does a commercial, but it really epitomizes this kind of robber baron buccaneer kind of capitalism. We got the power to grab more, and you know, Bob, you mentioned the Russia thing. At some level, it's business dealings. It's oil. It's you know, we're gonna play nice with Putin and so on, because after all, our, you know, Secretary of State is the man from ExxonMobil at this point, and ExxonMobil has vast holdings and investments across Siberia and the Arctic in partnership with Rosneft and so on. So the two together, this kind of lower level kind of spat with Nordstrom's and then Kellyanne Conway's commercial.
You know, this is like the living experience of the famous big lie technique, is Donald Trump, to no small extent, got elected by claiming he would drain the swamp. He's running against the corruption, the money power in Washington, the powerful special interests. He's closing ads in Wisconsin and around the Midwest. Could have been Bernie Sanders ads, with the exception of the stuff about immigrants. Everything else was just a left-wing populist ad against concentrated wealth, wrecking the living standards of the working class. And, you know, he was going to drain the swamp. Yet here he is, unquestionably, ironic, but no sense of irony, the most corrupt administration by miles already of any we've ever seen before. And I'm reminded of the Dallas Mavericks owner, Mark Cuban, the basketball team owner, who was thinking about supporting Trump. And he had several long conversations with him on the phone late in 2015 and early in 2016 to sort of feel him out, because he liked the Buccaneer style of Trump. And he said, finally, after he talked to the guy a few times, he said, I'll do anything I can to make sure he's never president of the United States, because all he cares about is getting rich. He said, we try to talk about policy. All Trump would talk about how much money he's making, how much he's going to make. And we're seeing it now. I mean, he comes into office, as Matt pointed out, he could already be impeached for ethics violations right out of the gate, because he's still holding all his assets and still working them while he's president of the United States. It's really an unbelievable situation we're in with Trump, with this corruption. And, you know, it's hard to imagine anything this severe. And the Ivanka thing is just one more example of it.
Right. I keep thinking of the classic Woody Allen movie Sleeper, where the scenario is that Woody Allen is they wake him up after being asleep for 400 years.
Yeah.
And the doctors, the scientists, and people, they flash a picture of Richard Nixon up on the screen, and they say, well, we think this man might have been president, but there's no coins, no stamps, no actual record of his existence. Are you familiar with him? And Woody Allen, looking at this picture of Nixon on the screen, you know, he says, oh, yeah, he was president of the United States, but he was so corrupt that every time he left the White House, the Secret Service counted the silverware. And I keep thinking of that particular line. Let's go back to the phones. Don, hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the program and the topic. On a personal level, I happen to work for the United States Postal Service, and we're federal union, and many of my coworkers voted for Donald Trump. And as anyone who's followed the Republican project, public union sector unions are squarely in the target, the bullseye of their plans, and so it was almost like cutting their own throats. But it's kind of a microcosm, to me, is an example of the failure of the left, or progressives, or whatever term we want to use. And I was kind of hoping, well, with the Obama administration, but certainly with the Trump administration, there would be some introspection on left, among leftists, as to why we're failing so miserably to reach people like the folks I work with. And my opinion, for what it's worth, is there's two big problems. One is accommodation to the Democratic Party, and hence the neoliberal project. And we can discuss that to some extent within leftist circles. People will be willing to discuss that at least. But the other problem is the complete submission to bourgeois identity politics. Now, you know, the minute I bring that up, I'm a racist or misogynist or what have you. But if the living examples of Condoleezza Rice and Barack Obama and Eric Holder haven't put the left to some pause into bourgeois identity politics, I don't know what it's going to. And I'm just wondering, for myself, the, you know, allegiance to these two areas have completely defeated the left, and we're not able to reach out to most people. And I'm just wondering about your opinions on this. And
well,
I will hang up and listen over the air to your answers.
Well,
thanks.
Thanks, Don. Well, first, you know, Bernie Sanders was reaching a lot of these folks. And Bernie Sanders was able to, by entering the Democratic Party, almost become the nominee of the party and president of the United States. Had it not been for the duplicitous tactics of the Democratic Party nationally, the DNC, and the stacking of the deck by Hillary Clinton and her people, Bernie very well may be president today. And I think he was talking to some of those union folks who voted for Trump. I mean, I do think there's a problem within the union movement of not educating their people, too. We saw that problem up close and personal here in Wisconsin when, you know, one-third of union households voted for the guy who had, you know, his boot on their neck. I'm talking about Walker, of course. As for identity politics, I think it's just too easy a shot. You know, I think a lot of the politics coming out of the gay rights movement was has been just tremendously useful. This is, let's look at it. It's the biggest nonviolent revolution, social revolution in the country in the last 50 years. And I have a kind of offhand theory of left-wing politics that one movement after another has to keep carrying the torch and keep supplying energy and keep getting new people in. And certainly the gay rights movement has done that. The women's movement has done that. The Black Lives Matter movement has done that. I wouldn't scorn those movements for a minute.
Yeah, I agree with Matt entirely on that. And I would say that the rejection was of mainstream Democratic corporate Democrats, the DLC, Pentagon, Wall Street crowd. They were completely rejected in this election, that Hillary Clinton couldn't win an election. And I don't think blame Hillary per se, because it could have been any Martin O'Malley or Joe Biden or one of these other people. Was a rejection, basically, this is a party that doesn't stand up for working people. It doesn't stand for anything, and it's just business as usual. And Trump got elected by people voting against their interests because he said, I'm going to shake things up. And after, you know, all what people have been through, that sounded like an option, a risk worth taking. Bernie was getting, as Matt pointed out, Bernie was doing exceptionally well among a lot of the people who ended up voting for Trump, as well as getting young people galvanized in a way that hasn't been the case in my lifetime.
I think the caller's qualification is interesting. That is, he talked about bourgeois identity politics. That is, a kind of politics stripped of any notion of class. Right, that there are classes in this society, that there is a working class, and lots of folks collapse into that, yes, that kind of middle class or bourgeois notion of particular siloed identities. And what we have to do, of course, to build the kind of movement that we need in this period is to bridge those connections, create the alliances, and certainly inject a notion of class that has been absent really from U.S. politics since certainly the McCarthy era.
Yeah, I agree.
And there are a lot of groups working on that. There are groups working that on the activism side. There are groups working on that in the nonprofit sector that I've been involved in the last couple of years here in Wisconsin, where groups across issues, and I mean the ACLU, Planned Parenthood, the good government groups like League of Women Voters and Common Cause and Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, Citizen Action, the environmental groups. I mean, we're all working together in ways that are invisible to the corporate media and maybe invisible to the listener too, but I find that to be a very encouraging sign.
We do have a caller. So let's go back to that phone. We'll get this person in before we run completely short of time. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, I assume that's me. I wanted to get back to this issue of identity politics. I actually think that would make a good show for you to have, and I would suggest it could be done in the form of a debate between people who are continually raising the kind of point that the caller just did and people who have a different perspective in terms of how to approach things that are essentially divisions in the working class and how it intersects with things like racism and sexism, because I think the problem is not, you hear this all the time, and in fact it was actually one of the weaknesses, in my opinion, of the Sanders campaign, which is everything is kind of boiled down to this very narrow view of the working class, and basically what it consists of is that the working class is predominantly white male, construction type, old-fashioned union types of people. And so they never talk about the fact that, you know, their unions have been dominated for years by business unionism and things about how they actually contributed to keeping people divided in the working class. If you ever watch on TV commercials at any football game or anything, whenever they're advertising like a truck or a chainsaw and there's pictures of, you know, who's working hard, it's always white men. And so I don't actually think it's a problem of the so-called identity politics. I think it's a flip side problem of an institutional racism. And if you say that, then people immediately say, oh, well, I'm not a racist, and they get down to sort of prejudice on the individual level. And I would be curious to know what your guests think of that, and also if you would sometime have a show that could be more of a debate or a very, sharp discussion about this, because this is a constantly issue that's constantly being raised now. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, very quickly, caller, give me an email or a call, and we'll brainstorm on how to set up. I think that's a very good suggestion.
Okay, I'll do that, Alan. I don't have anybody in particular in mind, except for, you know, maybe I can think of a few people, but
maybe,
I would like to hear a comment on that from the guest, too.
Sure.
Thanks.
Well, you know, I don't think it really was a weakness of Bernie. One of the things I admired about Bernie Sanders during this campaign was he didn't just stick to his main speech that we've heard at Fighting Bob Fest for the last 12 years. He actually grew a lot in the course of the campaign or in the lead up to the campaign, because he started to talk about issues he really wasn't talking that much about before, including the horrible racism of our criminal justice system, for instance. And so I just saw him kind of reach out. His whole purpose in life seems to me to be still to overcome the divisions that are imposed on the working class and to bring people together across kind of divisive issues. And so I wouldn't fault him really on that score.
I'm with Matt on that.
All right. That's synced, Bob. Thank you. Got time for one more caller who's waiting, and then we'll head a bunch of other questions I'd love to get to, but we're running short on time. Caller, hello. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Alan.
Go ahead.
This is Steve calling. Is this me? Melania Trump. There was an article in New York Times before the election, and they discussed Melania Trump, and she actually came in 1995, and she came on a visa to the United States, but she worked under that visa, so that was illegal. And the only way to really check her status as immigration is to know what her visa permits said. It's pretty much confirmed that she's actually an illegal immigrant herself. She broke the law to get into the country.
Thank you, caller.
We don't really know that for sure, and I would be hesitant to assert that confidently. I want to leave Melania alone and only say at the Women's March on Washington, where my wife was at and participating in, the chants that she liked the most were "Free Melania" and "Melania, blink twice if you need help."
One thing we haven't raised, and it's so essential, of course, we were talking, and I thought of it when you were referring to the millennials and younger people even still, and that is the ecological crisis, the environmental crisis that is right in front of all of us, that is being denied by this administration. And the current political economy, capitalism has no way of dealing with this, with that. And so there's this collision course, and I think then when it T-bones the environmental crisis and the failure of the political economy, that's when we'll have that fascism we're talking about.
Well, I think what we know for certain is this administration and the party in power has absolutely no interest whatsoever in addressing or ameliorating the environmental crisis. And in fact, it's pushed down the foot on the accelerator figuratively on fossil fuel development to make the crisis speed up. It's exceptionally irresponsible. And that alone, along with nuclear war, one of the two great threats to our survival as a species. So, and that alone will galvanize opposition, but it enhances the existential crisis we're in as a result.
Yeah, but I don't think, Alan, that the guarantee is we're going to go to fascism. I think the environmental crisis plus the economic crisis plus the political crisis is a huge opening for the left. Yeah. Bernie showed it. Showed us the way, and we just have
and
to
these,
pursue that.
We have to understand, these guys know they can't win fair elections. They have to have the Electoral College. They've got to have gerrymandering. They've got to have money in politics. Anything remotely close to a fair election with high voter turnout and informed electorate is anathema to them because these policies can never win a fair fight.
Well, look, I want to thank you guys for coming in this hour. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff.